I'm Walter Altman, and the topic of our session today is religion, opiate for the poor. This is, of course, a reference to a dictum by Karl Marx, who said that religion is opiate for the poor. So we will be talking also about the Marxist concept of religion and relation of Marxism and religion and Christianity under this rubric. And I would like to start to point out that at the very same passage where Marx used the expression opiate for the poor, religion as being opiate for the poor, he also added saying, and a protest, against unjust conditions, against suffering. So actually, in that famous passage, what really became famous was a half of the passage, saying that religion is the opiate for the poor, and the second part, where he said that it's a protest against injustice, was kind of forgotten. Well, it was kind of forgotten by Karl Marx himself, because he really developed more than that first part of how religion, in his opinion, is an opiate for the poor, and did not develop the second part. But nevertheless, it is of some significance that it is there, and I think we can point out that it is not a mere coincidence that it is there. And anyhow, it is a certain has a certain potential of discussion even among Marxists of what religion in their view is. So the one topic was developed by Karl Marx, the other one not. You could raise the question and say, well, why did it happen? If you kind of put the thesis, that's what religion is, you would expect that he then develops one, opiate, second, protest. And it didn't come to the second one. Why was it? Well, it's a kind of a speculative question, but those who have posed that kind of question have suggested that it probably is related very much to the conditions of the church he found when he was living in the last century. So we would have to recall a little bit. Marx was developing these ideas kind of in the mid-19th century, so that was the time when the Industrial Revolution was going on in Central Europe, and he was reflecting on the mechanisms of capitalism, of that industrial development, and of labor, and so on. And what kind of church he had in his experience, that was a mainly kind of church, a state church in Germany, a state church. And it is a widely recognized and accepted fact that, with some honorable exceptions, the churches in the last century failed very badly in relating and reflecting and taking stances on the whole issue of labor. And we all know, whatever our judgment about capitalism is today and conditions under capitalism, but we do know that at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the conditions, living conditions of the laborers were very terrible. Children working 16 hours a day, and no security, and huge health problems and so on. So that was the kind of problems that Marx had in front of his eyes. That was the experience he had. And at the same time, there was predominantly the system of state churches, which were kind of established and often allied with those who were not the laborers, but who were the owners, and those who had profit in that development. So, of course, the whole experience of Marx kind of gave much more ground and reason for him to reflect, when he was reflecting these lines, of reflecting more the line of the opiate for the poor. Say, well, that's an instrument, religion is an instrument of the dominant classes, so that the poor people will have some psychological, we would say, relief in their suffering. So that would function as an opiate in their situation. And we also know that he then developed the idea that promising a life in heaven, people would accept better the unjust situations prevailing in their life now. So they had a promise of something bigger and better, so they would accept it now. And so he kind of developed in that line of the opiate for the poor, and probably that's the kind of suggestion I'm making based on some other people. Probably the churches were at fault and therefore contributed to such a vision of the role of religion. But of course, I'm not suggesting at all for us as Christians that is what is religion. But nevertheless, since then, Marxist ideology has spread all over the world, and this has become a view held by many, many millions of people around the world. So we have to take that seriously. Then I would like to bring up a second stage now, some sort of reflection on how possibly in Marx's system the other line could have been developed, and in fact some Marxists after Marx tried to develop it some way, so that line of a protest against injustice. And here I would have to bring in another important distinction in Marxism, which is the distinction between structure, or sometimes also said infrastructure, and then the superstructure. Well, what did Marx have in mind with structure and superstructure? Well, we kind of listen, structural problems or something like that. There is a Marxist influence when we talk in that way. The structure Marx saw in mainly in the economic system, the economic forces, the way they are organized, and the political and social as derived from there. But the way people work and how the product of labor and of work is used, by whom and how the division of labor is, and so on. These questions, how food is produced, how then industrial goods are produced, who owns what he calls the means of production, that would be capital, machines, and also the labor force, and who sells labor force. So the laborers would sell their labor force and get a pay for that, but would not be the owners of the product and so on. And the product would always have the profit, so it would be more than labor force and more than adding just capital and labor force and machines and other expenses, because it would be sold then with a margin of profit. That's the profit made. So that's what actually goes out of the labor force and is owned by a few and not by those who really produce it. That's now very, very briefly kind of reasoning that Marx established. And he said, well, these questions are, that's the structure, that's the basic structure. And it changes from time to time. And so he analyzed from the very ancient way of societies to get organized, how was labor and work done there, and moved on, and so on, feudal system, and came to capitalism. And then described capitalism as he perceived it. And in his vision, then said, well, that's going to bring about such amount of goods and wealth and production, that's a certain stage, and then we are going to move to the next stage, which would be socialism, and finally, at the latter stage, would be communism. Well, that's the basic structure of what Marx sees. Now, the suprastructure must be something else. So, what would that be? The suprastructure is the level of the ideas, of the theories. So he places on that level also education, because that is forming the ideas, building, that's a part, and the news, information, all the mass media today, we would say, all of that belongs to the infrastructure, and also, well, all cultural production would be superstructure, and also religion. So religion is also a part of the superstructure. These are not, according to Marx's view, are not the basic things, but they are derived. That's a second step, you could say. And they will be governed decisively by what the structure is. So they will kind of reflect what the structure realizes. So that's the basic. And then come the ideas. So kind of very much the opposite of what others thought, the whole idealistic trend under whose influence we are very much, that kind of producing ideas, you could put them into practice and that would change reality and things. Marx did not believe that fundamentally at all. Fundamentally, he believed, well, the system of production is being developed and it changes, new research, new machines, new tools are being discovered, that changes the way you produce goods, that will change the life conditions, and accordingly also the ideas will change, and also religion will change, the education will change, and so on. But all these realms serve the purposes which are established in the structure and the possibilities given them. So they are a sort of mirror of that. And you cannot expect really to change things through ideas, but only in the changing of the mode of production, also the ideas will be changed. Well, the way I put it to you is rather mechanical and sounds very absolute. And the big debate, even among Marxists, has been how much that is really the case in Marx. Because Marx, of course, himself also wrote texts which he wanted others to read, of course. And why did he do that? He certainly had some expectation that that could have some influence and that could help to change things in some respect. So isn't Marx contradicting himself in that? Well, quite a few researchers say, well, no, what Marx really said, they say, is that a sentence out of the Communist Manifesto from 1848, written by Marx and Engels, which says the dominant ideas at a given time are the ideas of the dominant class. So the dominant ideas at a given moment are the ideas of the dominant class. You see, if it says the dominant ideas, that implies that there are some others, but which are not the dominant ones, but there are other ideas. And these are, in fact, the revolutionary ideas. But they are not dominant, because the dominant class imposes the dominant ideas. And the picture becomes kind of complicated, even because the majority of the people, according to Marx, are exploited people, are oppressed people. So it's not a question of majorities, according to Marx, but it's a question of power, of having the means of imposing the ideas. Therefore, for example, the press, very important instrument, education, very important instrument, religion, according to him, important instrument, so that the dominant class, which is a minority, you can impose those ideas, and even people who are oppressed and would have all the interest of not holding those ideas, but holding revolutionary ideas, will accept these ideas. To give an example, some years ago, one professor of our seminary in Brazil, together with a group of students, had a project of survey interviewing the members of the congregation, of our local congregation in São Leopoldo. So they visited kind of the whole congregation, everybody, and had a questionnaire, many questions and so on. Well of all nature the questions, but one question was on why are the poor poor? And it was interesting that many of the poor people who then asked, what do you do really? They worked in a factory from the early morning until the evening, and they worked after hours because the income was so little and they had to do some extra job outside and so on, would give us an answer that the poor are poor because they are lazy. So that is perhaps a very, very clear example of what probably Karl Marx had in mind, saying, well, that's an idea, not of really in the interest of the poor, but it is clearly so an idea to explain why they are poor and always will be poor, and we cannot change it, if poor will be, because they are lazy. And or at least to say, well, it's their fault, and so say it's not the fault of the system, and so on. The poor themselves might accept these ideas. They heard it so often, it was taught, and so on, and suddenly they assume it themselves. That is what Paulo Freire, who is a Brazilian pedagogue, has become worldwide renowned because of his method of alphabetization, very efficacious in teaching to learn and write the populations and so on, called of introjected values. That oppressed peoples have introjected values. They have come from outside, but they are interjected so that they now accept it also and may say the same things. And that there are, for to be a liberation, he as a pedagogue to have a liberation, there must be a process of extrojecting again, getting out these ideas which have been introjected. So let me come back and say so that the dominant ideas would be, according to Marx, the ideas of the dominant class, and they would be spread through education, news media, and also religion, and therefore have the function of opiate for the poor. But At the same time, he is then acknowledging the existence and is trying to foster the existence of revolutionary ideas, ideas which would be in contrast, in antagonism to, well, to the other ideas, but also then to the structure. So these ideas would kind of reflect not a given structure, but an intended structure out of the future. So he kind of contemplates that that possibility. And there, the revolutionary forces will get stronger and will come to actions and so on, and the revolutionary class will get organized. So the revolutionary ideas would play a role, not because they themselves would produce a new situation. That kind of fear non-communists have of the communist ideas, because they do believe, when they are idealists, they do believe that ideas can produce a new reality. So revolutionary ideas, they are very dangerous because they are going to produce a new reality. What for Marx then at best was only relatively possible. If there were not objective conditions, structurally seen, what he calls objective conditions, the organization of the society, the means, the machines, the tools, the amount of goods being produced, and the technology, you can say, and so on, a whole lot of objective conditions must be there for revolutionary ideas to become effective. Otherwise, there could be, according to Marx, the most revolutionary ideas, but if the objective conditions are not present, that won't change the reality. Will be perhaps a dream, a vision, and so on. And Marx then even criticized what the utopian socialism, and saying that he was espousing a scientific socialism. So he was very critical of utopian socialism. It's kind of interesting. We usually associate utopianism with Marxism, but there are pages and pages of Marx criticizing utopianism, and now I'm proposing a scientific, as a claim of a scientific approach. And only more recent Marxist of a brand, which I would like to show to you too, kind of emphasize also a positive role in utopianism, a kind of a vision, a goal of where to go and of motivating and so on. But that was not really present in Marx's analysis. Well, okay, so that is the important distinction of structure and superstructure. And there must be certain conditions in the structural level, the economic organization of society, the economic system, in order for even alternative ideas, revolutionary ideas, to be effective. Otherwise, the dominant ideas will reflect what is the given economic system. That is more or less what, as much as I can understand it and transmit it to you, what Marx was saying. Now, Marx lived 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago. He died in 1883. So, after Marx, quite a bit happened. Many developments even took place in a different way than he predicted. And, well, that's a chapter for itself, but many Marxists and different currents. But here, in relation to the concept of religion, let me propose to you the two currents of Marxism. The one which we would call the dogmatic Marxism, and the other one we would call the pragmatic Marxism. Well, what is the difference between the dogmatic Marxism and the pragmatic Marxism? I think it's an important distinction also, probably, to understand what is happening in the Soviet Union today, or what is happening in China, and so on, that Marxism by no means is that monolithic in theory, that there are no discrepancies in different groups and ideas. And, well, and among them you can distinguish kind of two trends, the more dogmatic and the more pragmatic. Now, the more dogmatic line tends to, or even emphasizes, overemphasizes that kind of reasoning which says, well, the ideas and the superstructure, they reflect what the structure is, and develop a kind of what is called an orthodoxy. They have the right doctrine of Marxism, and that got established in the Soviet Union and then in the Eastern Bloc, and especially under Stalinism was then developed, and whoever would dissent would be persecuted. So there was a dogmatic orthodox line, and this line also saw this very mechanically. Well, there are given conditions in the economic, and then the ideas are determined by these conditions. So the superstructure is determined by the structure. While the more pragmatic line, which quite often was then persecuted by those in power and who had the dogmatic tradition, they would emphasize, no, Marx said that, well, it depends on the given conditions, but there is a relative role of the ideas and revolutionary ideas. So that's not mechanic, it's not deterministic, but there is a certain process, and everything depends on the praxis. And we have to see what is our experience, what is the praxis, and history develops, what are the new conditions, and these new conditions we have to reflect on these items. So they take a more pragmatic view of things. And this has a great relevancy to the question of religion, because the dogmatic, orthodox, Stalinist view and so on will stick to that word and say, well, religion is opiate for the poor, and that's what it is and always will be. And so they have the right doctrine, and it never will change. Marx said it, and that's it. And we just have to again and again apply this to new situations, but always will be that. And of course these forces will be pretty virulent against religion, again probably more than in the original system of Marx would be necessary, because Marx also kind of said, well, if the structure changes, so if we overcome capitalism and come to socialism, then religion will not be necessary anymore. We don't need that opiate for the poor anymore. So that will disappear kind of automatically. But the dogmatic line gets kind of nervous when the reality is not in accordance with what the dogma says. So then they try to push it and provoke it and may persecute religions, Christianity and other religions, in order to make the doctrine become true. They say it is true always, but when reality is not, so they try to give a help so that that religion will disappear then. Well, the more pragmatic line has a potential, at least, and I think in Latin America has developed in some places, developed, see. Well, we have to look again, more than 100 years, we have to look at the reality. What is the reality? What are the forces? What is the role that the church has played? Is it still the same role of the church Marx knew? Or do we have grounds to see that it is different? So what? And it depends on the praxis. And then we develop our theory. And then they start remembering that Marx also said that religion is a protest against injustice and suffering. And started to develop that, okay, religion is also a very powerful force of protest. And you can go then through the religious elements, the religious traditions, the narratives of the Bible, the songs, and I mentioned yesterday, I think, the Negro spirituals. You can look into the Negro spirituals there, well, protest against the situation. So they start to develop that line, and suddenly they see Christians who are committed alongside with the poor and so on, well, struggling alongside with the poor, and the poor themselves being getting into a process in which they don't just accept religion fatalistically, so as under opiate, but start to do something motivated by religion and so on. Well, there must be something in that second line of religion being a protest against injustice and suffering. And Marx simply did not develop it, but that's a kind of missing link in his reflection. And we have, out of our experience, have to provide it. That's a kind of reasoning which goes on in the pragmatic line. Well, now let me try to exemplify from here on then on Cuba and Nicaragua on religion, and then open it for discussion. But I think that's these examples are good to show what I was trying to say here. Well, at the time of the Cuban Revolution, 1959. There were also the two tendencies present. And as far as we know, they continue to be present in the Communist Party in Cuba, even today. The more dogmatic and the more pragmatic. Well, again, we would have to ask, what kind of church did they meet at that occasion? And people who know the Cuban scenery, well, are pretty unanimous in saying that, well, there was the dictatorship by Fulgencio Batista, and the Catholic Church is the majority church in Cuba, very much allied to Batista. The Protestant churches were usually from U.S. missions, and the United States was also allied to the dictatorship of Batista. And after a first moment of some reticent support and so on, but when some economic interests were affected, immediately all these forces also went against the Cuban Revolution. And there was no experience of the church, of base communities, that was non-existent at the time. No experience of church being alongside the struggle of the people. So what happened in the Cuban Revolution then is that the dogmatic line got the control of the Communist Party in Cuba. And so also the vision of religion. And let me give the example of the Lutheran Church was kind of small there. There were a few U.S. missionaries down there. They left the country and returned to the safe United States. So, and for almost 30 years, the Lutherans in Cuba were without any pastoral assistance by Lutherans. They received them from Methodists and so on. And only right now I'll come back this year. Finally, a Brazilian pastor, Lutheran pastor, and a colleague of mine at the seminary, was permitted through Lutheran World Federation to go to Cuba and try to find the Lutherans who still are there after those 30 years. Well, but anyhow, more dogmatic tradition than one, and again a kind of vision, well, religion plays a role as opiate for the poor, that's very clear, was alive with Batista and so on. Now, after that, we have in Latin America all that renewal of the church. Well, already Vatican II, the Catholic Church, and then the movement of base communities, very decisively so, and struggling alongside with the poor people. And so a new experience, something completely different, is present there. And then in Nicaragua it happens precisely that also within the Sandinista movement, which is Sandinista Party is not the Communist Party in Nicaragua. The Communist Party in Nicaragua did not join the guerrilla against Somoza. But nevertheless, there is a certain Marxist influence in the Sandinist ideology, if you want so. But Sandinist ideology is something, has some particular features of its own. But there is a Marxist influence too. Also, you could kind of detect a more dogmatic and a more pragmatic line. For a long period, also under the light of the experience of Cuba and so on, the more dogmatic line was prevailing under the Sandinistas. Till they came to a certain point that they were not going to win. At the same time, they saw the movement of base communities and so on. And a certain convergency of the two started to build in Nicaragua. And then at the final stage of the insurgency and then the Sandinista revolution, there was an open cooperation of the Sandinista forces, now under a pragmatic vision, because the pragmatic ones had kind of suggested, said, see, there's something different here going on, and we have to change, and so out of that process came actually the Sandinista victory in Nicaragua. So a new model. And the pragmatics are still the leading ones in Nicaragua, in spite of all the fact of the, you know, the Contra War and so on, which, of course, what is the effect of such a policy from outside now trying to crush down such a development is the effect of giving reasons for the dogmatic ones again. So the dogmatic ones say, see? It was just an episode here, but we cannot trust. And also religion will play a role, and again, very tragic, the kind of gap that developed between the Catholic hierarchy in Nicaragua and the base communities in Nicaragua, because again, there is a kind of suggestion, because the hierarchy is taking such stances, oh yes, religion is playing the role of opiate for the poor. But nevertheless, up to now, the more pragmatic forces, and Daniel Ortega is one of them, the more pragmatic ones, are still the leading people within the Sandinista movement. And, in fact, the Sandinista issued a paper on religion, thesis on religion, which are completely out of line for a dogmatic Marxist view of religion. And a central sentence in that document by the Sandinista Party reads that our experience teaches us that whenever Christians, motivated by their faith, join the struggle of the people for liberation, faith or religion plays a liberating role. That's a very fundamental sentence, which changes dramatically the concept of religion and places the main emphasis on the second line of what came out of Marx, protest against injustice and suffering, religion. But even more so, say, now it has exercised a liberating role. So it's not only a protest, but also has a liberating effect. Well, that is something new in of the Nicaraguan experience. I think there are some parallels in Zimbabwe, the experience in Zimbabwe. And this experience is refluxing now into Cuba. And so suddenly the pragmatic ones also in Cuba have new reasons to talk and say, look, it can be different, and we can take a different approach in relation to religion. And one important chapter in that is that Fray Beto, B-E-T-T-O, that's not actually his name, but he's known all over Latin America as Fray Beto. His name is Libanio Cristo, and known then as Fray Beto, who is a Brazilian, Dominican Brazilian, very instrumental in giving support to the development of base communities and great connection with the whole movement of base communities in Brazil. In the late 60s, he was imprisoned by the military, Brazilian military, wrote letters out of prison. These are published in English by Barbis Books. Well, anyhow, he continues to be one of the leading figures in giving support to the movement of base communities throughout Latin America, and has been invited several times by base communities in Nicaragua to hold courses in Nicaragua, and then at a certain moment was also invited to Cuba, and was even received by Fidel Castro. And at a second or third visit, he managed to have, I think, about 24 hours of interview with Fidel Castro on religion. And this book, Fidel Castro on Religion, where it goes on as a conversation. Fidel Castro talks at length about his knowledge of the Bible and how he sees the stories of the Bible, and also about his education as a Catholic, and well, all things of all sorts of things. But then raising some questions, and Fray Beto then giving some lectures on liberation theology, on base communities, and so on. And this has been published, and it's a bestseller all over Latin America. It's translated into English too. I unfortunately don't remember which publishing house. And in Cuba itself, it was reported when the book came out and the news came, that was such news for Cuban people that people would stand in line to buy that book, something new. The communist version of the communist party in Cuba had been the dogmatic one, and now Fidel Castro was kind of suggesting different things. So that brought a whole new development which is going on in Cuba today, the vision of religion, and in the context of that, the spaces of organization for the Catholic Church in Cuba have become broader again, and also in the context of that change, it was possible for the Lutheran World Federation then establish a deal with a Ministry of Religious Affairs in Cuba to have a Brazilian Lutheran to come back to Cuba to minister to Lutherans in Cuba, and also to teach at the Ecumenical Seminary in Matanzas, Cuba. These are very new developments going on. So what I wanted to do today was to give you these kinds of information and of developments which are going on, and see that there is a process in it, which we don't know where it will lead still in the future of Latin America, but it is an ongoing process. Okay, I welcome your comments. It has been quite a long lecture now, but we still have some time.
Do you think that civilizations with large numbers of people going through the industrial changes and revolution could have evolved or evolved except through the dogmatic means. In other words, they had to grab hold of authoritarian structure first before you can evolve into a pragmatic.
Well, that's a good question. Whether would it be possible to start with pragmatic and then, but no, first more dogmatic view and then an opening, kind of this, what we see in the Soviet Union going on, or in China, and so first a very dogmatic, strict system, and then at a certain point a more pragmatic view coming up.
Is it a natural evolution?
Yeah. Well, I don't know really. I prefer to put my hope that the other way is possible too. And the Zimbabwean experience kind of gives hope in that direction, and the first couple of years in Nicaragua gave a strong hope in that direction, but that's very difficult now. But I think you're right in pointing that historic examples are of revolutions usually are that pretty soon there is a very dogmatic system established and trying to reinforce it, and only later on kind of an opening will take place. Yes?
Would Marx say that the arts like painting, poetry, novels would be part of the superstructure? Because often they're very critical of the state.
Yes. Well, he probably still would say the majority of the intellectual, the major part of the intellectual production would be just dominant ideas and be in service of the dominant interest. But yes, I think he made use of that too, that as a kind of the revolutionary ideas will be expressed through culture and the products in the arts and so on. But probably then he still would maintain that is a minority, a revolutionary minority even there. Yes?
To what extent would Christian Marxists hold to the idea that religion to some extent reflects, is a superstructure reflecting the structure? In other words, that the predominant way in which religion is articulated in a society is an ideology used to support the dominant interests.
Yeah. But yeah, to what extent Christian Marxists would still hold the idea that religion is a part of a superstructure and not the structure? Well, first, I think the term Christian Marxist, a Christian Marxist is, or Marxist Christian, I don't know, it's a kind of difficult concept. Some people use it, but not too many, because Marxism, of course, implies not only this, but implies a whole set of values, and if you take it as a whole system, then would be atheistic with the whole Marxist ideology. Some people will say atheism is not in the essence of Marxism because of this. It's a superstructure problem, and Marx in his time was then atheistic, but that's not in the essence of Marxism. Some will argue that, but nevertheless it's very much present. So it's kind of difficult to say what a Christian Marxist or Marxist Christian would be.
I don't think I phrased my question very well. Maybe I could put it this way. To what extent might a Christian who uses Marxism as a tool for analysis hold that Christianity can sometimes indeed be, as Marx said it was, a superstructure reflecting the dominant?
Well, I think that Latin American liberation theologians who then use not Marxism as such, but Marxist social analysis, so a part of Marxism to understand society, and will use to a good extent this terminology of structure and superstructure, will probably say that you can find throughout the history of the church and in the manifestation of religions these phenomena which Marx analyzed, but that by no means that is all what is religion, and by no means is the very essence of religion. That religion is much more. Well, is the relation with God, and then out of the relation with God, the relation with one another, and then it is the faith, and it is the motivation out of faith, what it brings. It is a way of living. It is a spirituality, and so on. And all of these issues, Marx, at the best, left aside, but when he kind of talked about them, put them all in the concept of superstructure. But that the theology of the churches and the institution of the churches, the structures of the churches, very often along the history, serve the purposes of the dominant ones, and therefore in that sense were part of the superstructure in relation to the structure, I think is kind of undeniable that this happened throughout the history. But that's not religion. That's at the best a part of it, manifestation. Yes?
When a country follows what you call a pragmatic approach, does it not tend to get two churches, an older church tied to the way things were, and a new church that holds the Dios de los Pobres? And if so, how do they work that out within the church? How is that? What have you seen? They're working it out among themselves. Yeah.
Well, that's your question of asking where there is that kind of model. You're probably asking kind of from both sides, from Marxist or governmental side or Sandinista side, and from the church side, so the kind of pragmatic view, where that would be the case. And then the second question, doesn't that divide the church really in two?
And what is the church doing about that?
What is the church doing about that? Well, that's a big issue. The Nicaragua and Nicaraguan people and the churches in Nicaragua are struggling with. And we don't have the final results yet. I think there was a very promising start, and then suddenly came a certain split within the Catholic Church, partly because, most people in Latin America will say, because the Pope did not have the instruments to understand the Nicaraguan situation, but kind of looked into that situation out of his Polish experience, where there is a dogmatic, Stalinist, bureaucratic system established and also oppressing the people and so on, and looked into that situation with those eyes. And the Catholic hierarchy in Nicaragua was in its majority kind of related with a business people, enterprise in the country and so on, and were also had also kind of tendency of not looking with the eyes of the poor people to the situation, and suddenly a split developed in the Catholic Church in Nicaragua, with the hierarchy on one side being critical to the government and the people not understanding that really, because their experience had been an experience of getting being both things, Christian and revolutionary. This is still going on. When I was in Nicaragua twice, I spoke with some especially young people, for example, who would say, well, we believe that we could be Christians and revolutionaries in our country, but if the Archbishop tells us we cannot be, and we are forced to choose, we won't betray our people. We will have to renounce to the Catholic Church here then. They would say, well, we'll still maintain our faith, but they were very realistic in saying, well, we will be kind of alone. So if that would be the prevailing development, then of course probably as a kind of reflex also the dogmatic forces within the Sandinista would become stronger and stronger. But still the base movement is so strong that I think there is a strong element of continue to develop that kind of language is promising to some extent. And if you move to other Latin American countries like Brazil, there was not that kind of split. There are tensions, but not that clear split as in Nicaragua. So the hierarchy has been supportive of these developments and of this view. So that's very promising for the future, but it's also a question of the future still. I don't know enough about Zimbabwe, for example, to know how it is working there, because in Zimbabwe, as much as I see, there is the Marxist element, and there is the Christianity, and there are the traditional African beliefs, but some similar developments, I think, have taken place there. So, I really can't answer your question, in spite of the fact that I talked quite a bit.
Yeah. I can just add that there's a fascinating analysis of that whole question, and especially looking at the whole visit of the Pope. There's about a 20-page article, I think it was in October or November of 86 in Atlantic Monthly. It's called God and Man, unfortunately, but God and Man in Nicaragua. I can't remember who wrote it right now, but it looked at that whole question of the split in the church and in relation to the Sandinista government, especially in light of the Pope's visit and looking at how the Pope really just completely misunderstood what was going on.
Yeah. Okay, perhaps a final remark we have to turn. One final point is kind of interesting, isn't it, that in the developed countries, both in East and West, atheism and materialism and secularism and so on have become very important in various ways, but rather different from what Marx expected. He did not expect that capitalism in a developed form to nourish secularism and atheism and materialism, and it's very much a part of the Western world, as well as in the Eastern communist experience, while the poor countries, Latin America or Africa and so on, kind of bringing out a different experience, and where atheism is not really a big challenge and temptation, and secularism not either, and so on. And the new experiment in how religion functions seems to be developing. That's a very interesting, if you look at the world scenery. Thank you very much.